and welcome aboard the Battleship Pretension. I am Tyler Smith.
I am David Bax.
And thank you for listening. David, how you doing?
Well, I'm okay. I'm safe.
Happy New Year.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Yes. Happy New Year. This is our first episode of 2022.
Yeah.
As you might have guessed, the listeners might have guessed, it is still 2021 at the time of recording, indeed, which is why it took me a second. But yeah, happy New Year. No, I'm feeling safe from Adam McKay because I didn't post a review.
Have you marked yourself as safe?
Safe from Adam McKay. I didn't post a review of Don't Look Up. I'll talk more about Don't Look Up the next time we do a movie journal. It's I will say it's not nearly as bad as Vice.
Okay.
And not quite as bad as a lot of people are making it out to be, but it's still not a good movie.
Yeah.
But I'm trying to find, and now I can't. Okay.
Oh boy.
Here is what Adam McKay tweeted. This is, I feel like that our top of the show, like, topic has become like what's going on film Twitter.
Sure.
But,
I need to know these things without actually being on there.
Adam McKay. Well, let's start. Okay. This is Twitter used to just be 140 characters. Now it's 280. I think this is an argument in favor of being 280 because there's fun stuff to unpack here, which is, let's start with the first sentence of what he said, which is, loving all the heated debate about our movie.
Oh, okay.
Which I guarantee he's not loving all the debate. What he means is, I'm trying to be diplomatic about the fact that every critic hates our movie.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, at least it's better because I did see the Twitter response by Seth Rogen about, what is it, Santa Inc. or something like that.
I didn't see this.
No. It was this, again, I haven't watched it. Very few people have watched it, as apparent, and those that have say it's awful. It's like an HBO miniseries. It's done in sort of a Rankin Bass kind of way.
Okay.
As a lot of Seth Rogen stuff is, it is half-assedly political, just very, very broad and all that sort of thing. And it was not getting good reviews, and, you know, of course he comes in and says, it's like something like, we're pissing off the right kind of people. It's like, this is exhausting.
That kind of ties into what Adam McKay, this is part of the fun of doing this film Twitter thing, is because you are always fresh eyes on this. So you can help us unpack, is Adam McKay really saying what he's being accused of saying here?
Okay.
So he says, loving all the heated debate about our movie, but which still makes me laugh. But if you don't have at least a small ember of anxiety about the climate collapsing or the U.S. teetering, I'm not sure Don't Look Up makes any sense. It's like a robot viewing a love story. Why are their faces so close together? And so what a lot of people have taken this to mean is that basically disliking Don't Look Up is the same as being a climate science denier.
Yeah, it's Bill Maher presenting Best Documentary the year that Religious came out and was not nominated, where he was the presenter and he mentioned that it wasn't nominated, and then there was like a slight chuckle from the audience, and then he goes no, religion is a very sensitive topic. It's like, hey, I see what you did there. You said like, I get it. And it's like, no, I don't think you do. Yeah. I think you are saying what you need to say, what you need to tell yourself, to convince yourself that the reason it wasn't nominated isn't because it's a bad movie, because people couldn't handle it, man.
I want to look up what the nominees actually were that year to see if they were all very safe topics.
Sure. Yeah.
But again, it's the Academy, so
it could
probably
have been. Yeah.
Yeah, that probably was, but it doesn't make Bill Maher's point correct. So this seems to, I don't know if this is like, I want to give Adam McKay the benefit of the doubt, and that's not actually what he's saying. But I think, I guess what I want to talk about here more than is disliking Don't Look Up the same as climate science denial is the way that things get flattened on Twitter.
Sure.
You know, like people just run with an interpretation of a thing and retweet, and with every retweet, it gets flatter and flatter. And
right.
People go more to one side or the other. Do you know, I mean, you've mostly avoided Twitter, I think, for this reason.
No, I the conversation eventually just becomes sometimes about itself, and anything like intent or certainly context is removed, and then eventually people are just debating each other's interpretations and maybe even are removed from what sparked the whole thing. So how is film Twitter taking it? Sort of the way I did just now.
Well, how would you describe how you just took it? Like,
if I want to give him the benefit of the doubt.
Yeah. Film Twitter is not giving him the benefit of the doubt, because film Twitter is mostly made up of, at least the film Twitter that I'm a part of, is film critics or people who are like the film. Yeah. There's people who are sympathetic to film critics. There's also a lot of film Twitter that is absolutely not sympathetic to film critics.
Sure.
And that's like the MCU Twitter and that sort of thing. But most of this are people like taking this as an attack on critics, or at the very least a misunderstanding of what critics value, what a critic's role is, and what criticism means, which I'm definitely sympathetic to that. Like,
sure.
Is Adam McKay not capable of processing the idea that people might be sympathetic to his politics, but still think that he made a bad movie, that he made his point in a bad way, or that the movie is the things it's being accused of being, which is very broad and condescending and screechy and shrill and
yeah.
And obnoxious and thin and superficial and all these things. Is Adam McKay, and maybe this is, you know, I'm not an artist. Maybe this is something Adam McKay has to do to like protect himself. Maybe he has to say like, no, they don't like my movie because of these like politics reasons or whatever. Instead of absorbing the actual substance of the criticisms.
I mean, it's certainly, I'll say this and I think it's worth comparing. I've certainly seen plenty of like directors of Christian films, which obviously have a message to get across, and often do so clunkily, if I'm being generous. And then there are people that will, those that do see them tend to, there are a handful of people that are so on board with the message, they don't care about the film itself. But then anybody who cares about film as an art form are just like, oh, you could have done this much, much better. Mm-hmm. And there definitely have been directors who jump to their own defense, and they're basically defending their intention. And because they're thinking so firmly about what they meant, that in their mind, or maybe, again, maybe it is something that they just need to tell themselves. In their mind, it's like, well, this was the intent. So if you don't like it, you must not like what my intent was. And so I do think there probably can be a bit of a disconnect when, especially with a film like Don't Look Up, similar to Vice, similar to The Big Short, not to suggest the type of movie they are, but you know, he's led with anger, and he's led with frustration. And I think there tends to be, in his directing style and in his writing style, there's a certain histrionic quality to it that sometimes comedically can really work, and other times, as we've discussed in Vice, doesn't. And I think for a good portion, there were a handful of critics that really did not like Vice, but for the most part, it was very rewarded by the Academy and all that sort of thing. I think this is the first time that an instinct that has served him well, and it's still just him trying to express a frustration artistically. I think this is the first time that instinct has been questioned, and And I don't necessarily want to like come down on him. But yeah, it's like when you've been told, when you're told over and over again, like, hey, we love what you're doing. And then you just do what in your mind is just the same thing. You start to think like, oh, well, it must be the issue itself because I'm not doing anything different.
Well, yeah, I think I want to address two things you said. One, you said that his movies are motivated by anger and frustration. I think that's very much true of The Big Short. And that's one of the things that I liked about The Big Short. Mm-hmm. I think Vice is more motivated by condescension than than anger. And I think Don't Look Up is probably still more condescending than angry, but has some like, it has some like actual like righteous indignation to it that I think,
yeah,
that's why I say it's not nearly as bad as Vice. So that's just that. I just wanted, and again, well, I'll talk about more of that. I'll talk about that more on the next Movie Journal episode. But the other thing you said, you mentioned the Oscars, because that's where some other people have taken this, some sort of like conspiracy theorist type people have saying like, oh, this is a ploy to equate disliking Don't Look Up with being anti-climate scientist is and like an Oscar PR like campaign move that you're going to help the movie's chances with the Academy by getting it in people's minds that like, oh, voting for this movie is saying I care about the environment.
I mean, it's,
I don't know that Adam McKay is actually thinking that, but I also don't know. I wouldn't rule out that might be a side effect of what has happened here.
There have been some pretty shameless Oscar things. You know, for 12 Years a Slave, there was like an ad for an FYC ad that said like, it's time or something like that. It's like, what are you talking about? It's just, look, it's a movie about something that's quite horrifying, but like, it's not like this film's nomination is going to fix everything, you know? But they're definitely playing into not the film, but what the film is about to try to garner support. So I wouldn't be surprised. But I also don't think that Adam McKay cares that much about the Oscars. Maybe I'm wrong, but.
Well, you just reminded me, this is getting way off topic and then we can just get into the episode and everything. But you reminded me, you mentioned 12 Years a Slave and it reminded me of one of my favorite tweets of all time.
Okay.
On November 6, 2013, Paris Hilton, more on her later, Hilton tweeted, just watched hashtag 12 Years a Slave. It made me so sad, angry, and disgusted that people could ever treat each others in such a horrible way. Frowny face emoticon, hashtag so wrong. which I was thinking of recently because a Paris Hilton movie tweet got passed around again. A new one showed up recently, which is like so funny that I think Natalie and I actually had a discussion like, she knows what she's doing here, right?
Right.
So someone tweeted at Paris Hilton, did you watch House of Gucci? It's not romantic at all, but it's very entertaining. And she replied, I want to watch it, but it's only playing in movie theaters and I'm on my honeymoon on a private island.
That's, I mean, is the, it, that is absolutely what like a parody account would say.
Yeah. But it's, but she is, I mean, she did recently get married, so we know that to be true. So it's probably true, but I wonder if she knows what she's doing.
I don't know. That's almost, it's so perfect.
Yeah.
And maybe we're all underestimating her sense of humor and self-awareness.
Well, as I've said for years, and I've said on this podcast before, there's a part of me that will always be sympathetic to Paris Hilton because of the House of Wax ad campaign that made me feel so bad for her.
Yeah.
To rehash it, I'm sure the listeners know because we talked about it before, to rehash it, like Paris Hilton was an actress in the movie House of Wax. It's a slasher type, you know, horror movie. Yeah. So her character gets killed. And then there were like literally like billboards and shit that were like, see Paris die, like playing on like sort of pop culture, exhaustion with the whole Paris Hilton Simple Life type of thing that was happening at that time. And it always felt like, I always felt so, because there's like, she didn't sign up. to for that, like, she signed up to be an actress in the movie. It also happened like a much smaller and less offensive version that happened. Paris Hilton shows up as an actress in one episode of Veronica Mars early in season one. And then late in season one, there's a character who like has gone the whatever the 2004 version of viral was for like some bad behavior at a party. And she's like, and she says something like, "I'm going to be a laughingstock like Paris Hilton or that Star Wars kid." And that felt like very like you had her on the show, but like,
yeah,
I don't, that's not nearly as mean as show up, buy a ticket to this movie to see Paris Hilton get, I think, like impaled through the forehead on like with like a camping spike or something. I saw the movie and I think that's how she dies. It's been a long time.
Now I will say I've seen, what's it called? I think it's called Crystal Lake Memories. And then there was Never Sleep Again. It's these very long
I remember
documentaries about Friday the 13th and Nightmare on Elm Street respectively. And one thing that they do say that like, all, cause they interview basically everybody that has ever been in these movies. And a lot of these younger actors say like, "Oh, I was a big fan of the series. And I was just so excited to see how I was going to die." Like, so it is possible that Paris Hilton was like a fan of these types of movies. She had to have known that her being a part of it is itself a stunt. I don't know if that means maybe she signed on to like, no, really play up that I die. But yeah, it's, so I guess,
yeah,
I guess wrong, I don't like the instinct.
Yeah.
That it's playing on regardless of whether she's on board or not, that they thought, "Oh, this will work. This will get people to the theater." I think I'm not thrilled with that.
But yeah, I like the idea that she's like Phil Hartman's Ronald Reagan. Like,
exactly.
As soon as the cameras are off, he's like a hard ass, like, you know, strategic general type.
Man, oh man. There are days when I feel very old indeed. And the fact that you referenced and I laughed at this sketch from the 80s. Yeah. Featuring an actor who died many years ago,
like 25 point. Years ago.
Something yeah. Like it was like, I think it was 98, 99. Okay. I don't remember exactly, but it's been quite a while. And so like, but that sketch is like very palpable for us. And we were young at the time, but yeah, it's kind of sad.
All right. Well, before we go any further, I want to tell you about tweakedaudio.com. Tweakedaudio.com is where you go for professional quality earbuds in a variety of stylish styles and colorful colors. They look great. They sound great. Tyler and I use them each and every day of our lives. Today, I was using mine to, as I will be doing for weeks to come, listening to all of the best metal albums of 2021 or what other people are saying are the best metal albums of 2021 to try and like catch up, see if I missed anything. And I listened to re-listen. I actually listened to this early in the year. Now metalheads are gonna like say this isn't a metal album, and that's kind of the point. A band called Chrome Waves, who were sort of had been a metal sort of like, you know the term black gaze? Do you know that term? No. I talked about it? Okay. Well, it's like a mixture of like black metal and shoegaze. It's also sometimes derisively referred to as hipster metal. They had been that kind of band before. Their new album, The Rain Will Cleanse, they're one of two basically like bands who were in this hipster metal category. The other bigger, much bigger one being Def Heaven, who both released albums in 2021 that are essentially not metal albums. They have a couple of metal like ingredients in the mix, but it almost felt like both of these bands had like spent so long of metal, like hearing metal fans tell them they're not really metal, they were like, "Fuck it, let's both make non-metal albums this year." So I was re-listening to the Chrome Waves album, The Rain Will Cleanse, and it's not really metal, but it's very good. And it sounded great on my tweakedaudio.com earbuds. They're available at a low, low price at tweakedaudio.com. But if you use the offer code pretension at checkout, you get 1/3 off that low, low price and no shipping charges. So please go to tweakedaudio.com and use the offer code pretension.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Okay, then, we're back, and let's get into it, shall we?
Indeed.
Sort of, I guess, sort of a companion piece to last week's episode, because last week when we were talking about age gap relationships in movies, I feel like I went out of my way to describe this as something that is like, I don't think that this makes a movie bad, you know?
Right.
It's just, it's something I notice in movies that tends to, at least for a moment or so, get me thinking about something outside of what I should be thinking about in the movie, you know? Yeah. And so we decided to kind of run with that and just like have fun talking about weird personal hangups and roadblocks we have that pop up when we're watching movies that take us out of movies.
Now this is, I was making my list earlier today, and I need to be very careful because you can only talk about hangups for so long before, at least I could only list them for so long before I started dipping into like certain plot choices that, or like story choices or structure choices that really bother me. It's like, that's a different, with a couple of exceptions, because sometimes it's like a character type, which for my own reasons, like bother me. But I needed to be very careful about that, because this isn't, it could be argued that none of the stuff we're saying is going to be, could be considered legitimate criticism.
It's not, this is about us, which last week was about us too, or at least for me was about me, but also kind of about the discourse, and trying to say, you know, I think last week what I was trying to say is that like, I'm not without a smidge of sympathy for the people piling on licorice pizza. I get where they're coming from, but that doesn't make the movie bad, or an age gap in a relationship doesn't make any movie bad necessarily. Right. Where I ended up coming down with a lot on this is like depictions of certain real world, like professions or like jobs, sure, things that I have experience in, or not just professions. Like, well, I'll say what's weird, as I'd already been thinking about this before the age gap thing, because as you and I talked about, I think on the podcast, maybe off podcast, the 2021 Leo Carax film Annette is very good. It's tearing up the best of lists this end of year time, but I really liked it. But also, Adam Driver's character is a stand-up comic in the movie, and that's often like a huge thing for me. And we talked about it, I can't remember, because all the pandemic time is all like, you know, mixed up in my head. I can't remember when exactly we had Wayne Fetterman on the show, but what was one thing we talked about is how rarely stand-up comedy is depicted in a way that seems at all real or believable or honest in movies. Like you can count on one hand the number of times you've seen it done well. And Annette was a particularly egregious example. And I understand like it's a high concept musical.
Sure.
His version of stand-up comedy is not meant to be like the real world version of stand-up comedy. Anyway, I get that. And that actually helped a lot in watching the movie, but there's still a part of me that couldn't stop thinking about like the people who, the Sparks brothers who wrote, came up with the story and wrote the music and stuff. Like, do they, I wonder sometimes if people from, because people, I think stand-up comedy is, to get highfalutin about it, it's maybe the most undiluted performing art.
Yeah.
But I think sometimes, or often in general, it's, if people think of it as an art at all, they think of it as a lower art form. And so people who are coming at stand-up comedy from an art world position can't conceive of stand-up comedy as anything but bad performance art.
Oh, that's interesting.
You know what I mean? And that's what Adam Driver's character in Annette is doing, is bad performance art. And to the movie's credit, like, I think it's supposed to be bad.
Okay.
But it's still, I still kept thinking, like, this has almost nothing whatsoever to do with stand-up comedy. This feels like Steve Buscemi's character in Life Lessons. If you know,
I was
like,
just thinking that, yes.
Yeah, that's the kind of thing it feels like. And I'm wondering if, like, if someone who comes from an art world who isn't exposed to stand-up comedy or do they have a tough time even conceiving of a false version of it?
I think, that's right. I was listening to, because again, I don't read books anymore. I can't do that. I got to listen to things while I do the dishes and clean up toys and all that kind of thing. But I was listening to Jerry Seinfeld's new book, which contains a lot of his bits, but also has introductions. And he said that, like, when he was a kid and he first saw a stand-up comedian, he was amazed. And he thought, how did they do that? Did they just go up and start talking? Like, and what he's essentially, as a kid, even though he's not aware of this, what he's aware of is the effortlessness, the appearance of effortlessness by a good stand-up. Like they know they're not coming up with this stuff on the fly. Occasionally, because they are funny people, they can throw something out maybe, but it's couched in a very well honed and crafted act and persona and cadence and all of that. And so I do think it's very possible, because this was one of mine as well. Because it's something you and I have talked about. It's like, and it keeps happening. Like, this, you'd think this shit would have stopped with Punchline, but no, it's still happening. I was looking up, sort of as a function of this, I was like, what are some of my least favorite movies of the last few years? And there is that movie, Last Laugh, with Chevy Chase and Richard Dreyfuss. And of those two, Richard Dreyfuss plays the stand-up, the former stand-up, that same year, I think that movie, Late Night with Emma Thompson,
right.
Emma Thompson can be a tremendously funny actress, but it's such a different skill set. But that's the problem, is I think that movie people, or, you know, highfalutin people, as you might think, I think they mistake the appearance of effortlessness for ease. And I think they think it's easy, because it's like, well, hey, it's just one person there. Like, they don't have to make this call or that call. They don't have to work with the studio or anything like that. It's like, yeah, they don't, but also, it needs to be, like, well honed, and there's tremendous craft that goes into it. And yeah, and there's also just, like, a body language thing. You and I have seen enough stand up, and we've seen good and bad. And even the bad ones, there is a certain degree of comfort with the audience and the fact that they don't have anywhere to hide. And when you see even the best actors, they can't mimic that, because it's something that just comes naturally over doing good sets, doing bad sets, all that sort of thing. And it is fascinating to me that they're still doing this, you know?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I guess it is. Neither of us is a stand-up comic, but I really want to, like, steer clear of trying to imply that someone who is a theatrical, like a stage actor, I don't want to imply that they don't have a relationship with the audience while they're performing.
Of course not.
But it's a different relationship,
yes,
than a stand-up has. And I think that is often where a lot of the falseness comes in. The way that they're playing to the audience is different than the way that a stand-up plays,
yes,
100%. To the audience. Because not that one is either one is better or worse, but it's a different relationship to the audience. And I think that's a big part of what, like, with the Robert De Niro in The Comedian or whatever. Right. It's just like, I just don't buy it. He's up there acting, you know, he's not.
Yeah.
I'll say, I didn't mention this. When I talked about Mickey Reese's Agnes on the Movie Journal, a recent movie, Sean Gunn's character is a stand-up, and we see a brief bit of stand-up, and it's, I think that's one way to do it, is that as little as possible.
Sure.
Just a little bit of stand-up. And I actually do like buy that this guy's a stand-up, that he has that mix of like, this is something that I've written and performed before, but also this thing that I'm doing right now is the only time that this will happen this particular way. I think that's a big, that's part of the mixture. And I think Sean Gunn,
I would buy him as a stand-up.
Yeah. Yeah. I think he gets it right. But again, it's a tiny little scene. Most of his scenes in the movie are not him doing stand-up.
Yeah.
But, yeah, so that was my number one, because of Annette, personal hang up or roadblock that I have.
All right. My number one, and I think I've said it on the show before, but it's so stupid and specific, but I guess that's the nature of it, isn't it? Of what we're talking about. All right. I think I was first aware of this when I saw Scent of a Woman, but I've seen it countless times since then. Okay. There's a scene where a guy is not wearing pants. He's wearing boxers and he puts pants on and he just zips them up and buttons them up. Okay.
I never thought of this, but now I will.
Oh, and my first thought is like, they're bunched up.
Yeah. You've got to straighten out the box. You've
got to straighten out. Here's this leg. Here's that leg.
Yeah.
It's like, it's not something that's necessary with briefs. And then like, it's even a little bit necessary with boxer briefs, but with just straight up boxer shorts. Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
And so they'll just do that. I'm like, you're ruining your day. You're ruining my day.
Yeah.
Like I can't. And like, certainly the rest of the scene is ruined, because in my mind, I can say like, well, at the very least between scenes, this character must have fixed it. There have been days, in my life where just through no fault of my own, like, you know, like in high school, like gym class or something like that, where you're running and just like, oh, these are all bunched up. It's like, oh, and it's the only thing I can think about.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So, and it's exactly what happens when I see that in film.
I'm trying to remember, what is the Rodney Dangerfield movie where he's like in a boardroom with like, I don't know, he's like pitching ideas for clothes or something. One of the things he says is like, trousers with an extra long zipper so that you can reach in and adjust your boxers.
Oh man. I don't remember that one, but yes, let's do it. So yeah, that was the first one that popped into my mind, because it's relatable to me, but it's so palpable for me.
Yeah. Oh, see, you're making me think of ones I hadn't thought of that are more like funny like that. Like, well, everyone knows, I feel like it's been talked about to death, the way that people in movies like hang up the phone without saying goodbye.
Yeah.
Which is always weird. Or like make plans to meet without hammering out like date, time and location. Like, okay, I'll see you. Okay. I'll see you Thursday. How about you want to have lunch on Thursday? Sounds great. It's like, where are we? Like, where are we meeting? That's a funny one. And that also reminds me of, because I mentioned this topic to Natalie and she brought up something that bothers her. Okay. It's usually the mom has made a breakfast for the kids. And for some reason she has like two kids, but she's made breakfast for like six people. And the kids are like grabbing a piece of toast and like, gotta go, mom. And there's just like a pile of pancakes and a big like pan full of scrambled eggs just sitting there like being wasted. That bothers Natalie.
Well, and it's obviously, I think it's supposed to bother you, 'cause it's supposed to show like the callousness of the kids or whatever it is. Like they're just not aware of what their mom's doing. But after a certain point, it's like, you think she'd learn.
Yeah.
Because I guarantee this is not the first time this has happened.
Yeah. How much bacon are you throwing away?
Exactly.
Every day. Oh, so I mean,
because like we feed our kids three times a day, and breakfast is, you know, you gotta be, because like they have not eaten for in our case, like for many, many hours. So they're starving. So you gotta be like ready immediately. Mm-hmm. And once they started eating solid food, like we learned roughly like how much we learned quickly how much they will eat and how much they will not eat. And it's like, well, we can't be spending this, you know, what am I, Rockefeller? Like I can't be spending money on eggs like this. And so she should learn. What was the man for the life of me? I can't remember what it was. It might've been Simpsons. It might've been, I feel like it was an animated show. Where somebody comes home and comes home late from work, and then the other person, because it's meant to be like a type of domestic thing. And the other person's like, he goes, well, the chicken is ruined. You know, it's like, it's completely dried out from being in the oven. And the guy's like, couldn't you have just taken it out of the oven? And so, like, and then she's like, oh, and is just so aghast at that. And so, yeah, it's the kind of thing where, like, I get why they do it, but yeah, it's the kind of thing that, yeah, that doesn't make a great deal of sense.
Yeah. All right. Well, I'll go back to you before I have more Natalie inspired ones to go with.
Okay. Okay. One that gets me, and this might, again, this might be a larger thing. Character names, specifically, just there's such a shorthand. So like if there's a character named Albert, unless he is Einstein, he's not going to be your lead. He's not going to be a hero. He's probably going to be at best a funny supporting character or someone that's meant to be dismissed by the audience. But then there are also like cool character names. For me, as much as I like The Sixth Sense, the moment I heard that Bruce Willis's name was Malcolm Crowe, I was like, what are you fucking kidding me? Like, and it's just that sort of thing. It's like, I suppose those characters do, those names do exist in real life. Ethan Hawke sounds completely like a stage name, but it's apparently his actual name. But for the most part, it's,
so you got a problem with bird names, it sounds like.
I guess I do. Crow, Hawke.
Raven.
There's Bob Vulture.
You hate that, so Raven.
I Raven Simone did come into that Blockbuster that I used to work at, and as I mentioned, she became my test because she treated me what seemed to me to be poorly, and then I realized, like, no, hang on, did she treat me worse than an average customer? And I realized, right, like, no, she has not. I'm only noticing it.
Yeah,
that's because she is famous.
That's, I hate to feel bad for famous people, but that's something I noticed, like, right away when I first moved out here. I would, like, be a PA, like, on sets or in offices. You'd hear stories about, like, oh, this person's so difficult. And it just means, like, you mean they didn't go out of the way to have a conversation with you while they're at work?
Right.
You know? Right. And I started to feel bad for actors who felt like they had to, like, be on and nice all the time just so people would not think they're a piece of shit. It's, yeah, just, let you know, it's a workplace, you know.
And then just to reinvigorate this mystery, because we haven't talked about it in a while, there was one person that did treat me genuinely terribly who, mm-hmm, has since been on the show.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We're never going to say who but I like to, every once in a while, I like to throw that out there because people were guessing for a while. So you can keep those guesses coming if you want. You're never going to.
Sure, yeah. We're never going to confirm it. But, yeah. Yeah. For all you know, people, you already have guessed it right. And we
exactly
will never tell you.
It was Scott and I. Anyway, the point is, that's the thing. It's like, that's like a script thing, but it's the kind of thing where when I hear names that are just so obviously meant to be dorky or obviously meant to be villainous or obviously meant to be heroic, what, or cool, you know, it's the first thing that you're hearing about this character. And when they indicate so clearly, that does, you know, it takes me out of it because you don't hear names like that in, with a couple, well, of exceptions, you don't hear names like that in real life.
The thing I think that I think about, and that's if someone's like name is supposed to be a shorthand for this person's like gross or a loser.
Sure.
I start thinking like, oh, what if there's someone named Ethel?
Oh yeah.
Watching this movie right now and just like got insulted.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And then I remember, similarly, there's this, the young me, when I first saw Dick Tracy, but this concept can go to names as well. I remember thinking like, well, maybe all these people became criminals because they were so ugly and everybody treated them so poorly. That's what I thought when I was 8 and saw the movie.
I love
it. It's like, maybe this person has a name that people just think is unheroic or whatever, and they treated them accordingly. And so it's like, well, I guess I have to do this now.
Yeah, there's probably some truth to that.
So anytime they do that in film, I'm treating it as like a social critique.
So actual social critique, and this is one that I'm going to lump together social workers and therapists.
Okay.
Because even before my wife became a social worker, I used to think about therapy, but I now, with social workers in movies, I think about this so much, and I can't help it because I know what my wife does for a living. Mm-hmm. And I think actual real therapy or social work is just not inherently cinematic because it's never done right in movies. I don't think there's ever been a fully ethical therapist character in a movie or a TV show. They're always like passing judgment, revealing too much about themselves, getting involved, like, because actual therapy, I think when people think about therapy, they think, oh, this would be a great like setting for a one act play because there are like breakthroughs or whatever. But it's like, yeah, there are breakthroughs or whatever, but we need like, you need 6 weeks of sessions where people just talk about like,
yeah,
whatever, like a phone call they got from their mom or like, you know, what their boss said to them, like boring shit for weeks on end is the only thing that leads to a breakthrough. There aren't actually, and therapists on TV and movies like Dr. Melfi of all, you know, as much as I love her, like she is way too involved, reveals way too much of herself. They're always like pushing the action, as it were. They're driving things, which is not, at least I guess Hannibal, the TV show Hannibal, he's supposed to be an unethical therapist. Right. So when he's doing like, I can't remember what they call it, psychic driving or whatever it's, they call it something in the first season. It's an actual term that I had to look up. But like sort of like Inception, like placing suggestions in the patient's mind. Like when he's doing that, it's supposed to be bad therapy. So that makes sense. But
go ahead. I do maintain that of all the different movie and TV therapists, and I understand artistically why they have to, you know, cut to the chase. I do think that Judd Hirsch's character in Ordinary People, the way he carries himself and the way those scenes are written, obviously you're dealing with Timothy Hutton's character. The character is dealing with very immediate trauma, the death of his brother and his suicide attempt. So of course he's in the midst of a tough situation. He's not talking about like the day-to-day stuff, but nonetheless, I do like the way that character is written. It really doesn't feel like he's leading the kid in down a certain path. Like I remember there's a very therapist type exchange where Timothy Hutton like smiles a little bit and because he thought something to himself, and Judd Hirsch says like, it's like, oh, what are you thinking? He's like, that I jerk off a lot. And then, and Judd Hirsch is like, does it help? And it's just like, it's, that just seems like there's no judgment there. And there's asking, it's like, well, this, you clearly thought this. So why were you thinking that? And let's head down that path. And that always seemed very honest to me. I've been to a number of therapists and I constantly talk about you. I couldn't say that anyway. But yeah, that one always seemed real to me.
Yeah. I need to go back to therapy. Cause I was in therapy for 3 years and I feel like as an adult, I was also in therapy like a little bit when I was younger, but like as an adult, I was in therapy for 3 years. And like, I feel like I got through a lot of shit, but then sometimes something will come up in my life now that I'm like, how did I go to therapy for 3 years and never talk about this clearly monumental like hang up that I have? Anyway, we're not here to like talk about therapy. What I want to talk about more, the thing that I've noticed more now is social workers. Either often social workers are depicted as bad at their jobs, but like because people don't know what social workers actually do, or the opposite is that social workers are not present when they ought to be. I talked about I'll talk about two 2021 movies. There was the movie Palmer that Justin Timberlake was in. So the premise here is that he is a convict recently out on parole for a violent crime. He has gone to move in with his grandmother. That's the only like living relative he has who like will take him. So he's still on parole. He's living with his grandmother. His grandmother has a renter who rents like an RV on her property or whatever, who has a small child, so that's the first red flag. Like that, or that should raise a red flag with a social worker. There's a child on the property and this is a convicted violent felon. Like is, are they going to be alone? Like that should already be a question. Then the grandmother dies and the boy's mom, who's a drug addict, goes off, like runs off and leaves the boy alone. And so the movie is Palmer, the Justin Timberlake character, essentially like becoming a father figure to this child. And the school teacher like knows it's happening and actually has like a little bit of a romance with Palmer, and like Palmer's high school buddy is now like on the police force. There's multiple mandated reporters who know what's going on, and social work is like almost never mentioned in the, in the entire movie. And like, I look, the movie is bad for other reasons. That's not why it's bad, but that is something the whole time that I'm like, there's no, how someone would be called. And if they weren't, at least one of these people, the teacher or the cop, would be reprimanded, if not lose their job for, for knowing this was going on and not
reporting. Oh, they'd lose their job. 100%.
And then the other 2021 movie is, Antlers, the, Scott Cooper horror movie, where Carrie Russell's character is a school teacher and finds out something's gone, like going wrong with one of her students. And like, basically like, with, there's no paperwork or anything, basically, like, I guess it's somewhat of a spoiler for Antlers, but like makes the decision to essentially adopt this boy, like as if that's something a school teacher could just do. Like, ooh, my, one of my students is in a bad situation, I'll take it from here. Who else is gonna do it? And there's like, they make some reference of like the principal called a social worker once, and that's like the only reference to it in the entire movie. And again, these movies are both bad for other reasons, but I just wanted to like bring this up as something. Oh, I have a third. This is a third 2021 movie. And this is a compared to that, it's a much smaller offense, but but I think gets more to the heart of what we're talking about, of like something that, or at least what I'm talking about here, like someone who isn't married to a social worker might not have like thought of this, but King Richard, did you see King Richard?
Yes.
Okay. So there's the part he like is making his daughters practice tennis in the rain. And there's the nosy neighbor across the street who was like threatened to call social services, whatever. He comes home from the practice in the rain and the social worker is there with two police officers.
Yeah.
And that, I think if you aren't like I said, married to a social worker, especially my wife spent 2 years in emergency response. She was that social worker. So like, I know exactly like a call, like my neighbor is making his daughters play tennis in the rain. That's not like an immediate threat. There's no way that's not an emergency response. That's not a show up right away type of call first. That's like investigate this in the next 3 to 30 days or whatever, like however it gets flagged. A social worker does not show up with cops unless they absolutely think there's a threat, because it's just a bad way to do your job, because a social worker wants the family to trust them, you know, and showing up with two cops after hours for a call that's not like physical abuse, you know, or a threat of violence or of history of violence or whatever, it's just bad social work. Again, I keep wanting to say this because I really feel like maybe I didn't make this point enough last week. I'm not saying this makes the movie bad. It's just the kind of thing that I notice.
Yeah.
And because of my personal experience.
Along those lines, you were talking about adoption, and having been through adoption, having taken many, many, many classes on adoption and read a number of books and all that. And the fact that, the finalization process takes a while. The idea that it's just like, hey, in the movies, like, hey, this kid doesn't have anybody to look after them. I'll do it.
Yeah.
I'm sure there's probably, I can probably just put an X somewhere on a piece of paper and be fine.
No. I'll just fill out that one form.
Yeah. Our kids are 18 months. We are responsible for them legally. We are their official guardian and it's still not finalized.
Wow.
Like they were born in 2020. It will not be finalized until 2022 unless something really happens in the next less than 24 hours, I guess, 24 hours. So yeah, so you look at that and it's like, that's ridiculous. But then also
it's like when you're uploading something and it gets hung up at 99%.
Boy, yeah. And it's not as though, and that's the other thing, is like when we've told like family members that, they're like, so does that mean that something could happen? And it's like, no, nothing's going to happen where the kids are, you know, are put back with, you know, their birth family or whatever. It's not that. It's just kind of being in this much, much, much further along than limbo, but still not officially there, which the biggest hang up is taxes and declaring dependents and stuff like that.
Okay.
But anyway, that's neither here nor there.
I have a question, but I don't know if it's an on air or off air question.
Oh, okay.
So we might have to cut it if you don't want this answered. Is legally, officially, is the boy's last name Smith?
Yes.
Okay. So that's done.
Yes.
Okay.
And you know what's interesting, incidentally, slight tangent. Because we only refer to them by their first names, mm-hmm. I forget that their last name is Smith. It's not as though, and it's not as though I think of the birth family in that regard. That's not the issue. It's more just like, oh yeah, that's weird. I feel like I would think this way with like a biological child as well. It's like, well, that's just Dashiell and Jasper. It's like, oh, but they've got my last name as well.
Yeah.
I've said their names on here before. It's fine.
You have. Okay. I didn't know if you had before. Yeah.
But yeah,
yes, there's not a situation where you're going to have to like introduce them by their full names, you know?
Well, it's
like they're showing up at the ball.
Excuse me. Yeah. Eventually, you know, when they get in trouble and I need to let them know that they're in trouble, I can say their first, middle and last name, but they haven't done anything. They're just adorable right now. But yeah, you know, you mentioned adoption. And so there's the adoption process, certainly, but it's also just the way, and this is something that unless you've been through the process and you take the classes, like, and certainly times have changed, especially in the last 20 to 30 years in regards to terms that are used. The idea of giving up a child for adoption, that's not really a term that's used anymore. Mm. And putting up for adoption is also not something. It's now I'm trying to remember the wrong ones are firmly in my mind. Place for adoption. Okay. And similarly, it's like, oh, we accepted a placement. You know, you learn these terms because that's part of it. And there's all kinds of reasons as to why the terms have changed over time. And as far as just how kids, because they're listening a lot earlier than you think they are. And they're processing it the way kids process things. And so, of course, terms like giving up or putting up, like it sounds very negative in some cases and very much like an inanimate object, like, oh, we put something up for auction, you know, like that's a tough thing. So
I've learned,
and that's something that I still hear occasionally. And if I hear it in something where, if I hear it from like in the last 20 years and somebody who's involved in the adoption process says put up or give up, I'm like, the writer did not do their research.
Oh yeah. I've learned from, again, being married to a social worker that, I almost never hear Natalie use the word like foster family, foster parent.
Sure.
It's like, it's caregiver is what they say. Mm-hmm. And there's a couple of reasons. One, 'cause there's like stigmas attached to the foster system, but also because often the people she's dealing with are relatives who just happen to not be the parents who were kids.
Right.
Like, she uses the generic term caregiver, and that's what everyone at her work does. But we still think, I mean, most lay people still think of it as like foster, but it's very rarely used in that actual world.
Yeah. And incidentally, you know, in the spirit of what we're talking about, and we can move on in a moment, but one thing that when you are an adoptive parent, you kind of commit to, and boy, and this is a term I don't like saying, you commit to like educating people and just like letting them know, like, hey, here's whether it be a term or a concept that maybe we can try to, that in the future, maybe we can move away from. And so if anybody ever has any questions about adoption, whether it be the process or terminology or anything like that, you're welcome to email me, Tyler@battleshipretention.com, because there are things that certainly that we still say because we've been saying it as a society for so long. And we're trying to remind ourselves to get away from that. And sometimes it's terminology, sometimes it's sentiment. Like so many people saying like, oh, those kids are so lucky to have you, you know, stuff like that. Mm. Which again, the sentiment, I get it. It's a nice thing. And it's something that we've heard from relatives and that sort of thing. But, and that's just one example. So if anybody has any questions about adoption, feel free to reach out.
The thing you hear all the time that I love is double trouble.
Oh, double trouble. I heard it a couple days ago. No, I guess it was about a week ago, but yeah, it's always led with a noise. Oh, double trouble. Yeah. And just, I love it. I hate it, but I love it.
Yeah, I want to start doing it.
yes.
I only have one more that kind of sticks out to me.
Oh, okay. I have a few, but I'm not that passionate about a lot of them.
Well, the other one, because when I was a younger man, after high school and then a little bit while I was still in college, I worked at a nursing home. And I often feel like nursing homes are depicted in ways that are unrealistic or unfair. But then I've also learned, cause I had that thing of like it being unfair. Nursing home employees are depicted as being uncaring or whatever. But then I've also learned because of what my mom is retired now, what my mom did for a living for the last few years of her career, which was like working for the state that she lived in. I don't know why I'm saying I could say the state, but anyway, the state that she lived in, working for the state, like, and they would essentially show up unannounced at nursing homes, hospices, like any sort of any place that's licensed by the state, they would show up unannounced and find out and then like do an audit and see if they're actually like following the rules and realizing like, oh, there actually are a lot of places that treat their patients very poorly. So now sure. I've backed off that a little bit because I've realized like, okay, maybe I happen to work at a good nursing home. I think often the like depiction of nursing homes as if the nurse aides and nurses are like wardens and guards, you know, yeah. is not really fair. Like there's more of a relationship, I think, but then there is also a sense of like, this is our job and we have like taking care of these people does require us to sort of keep a checklist and check those things off and move on to the next person. So like sometimes there is that detachment that I think people reflexively see that as a bad cold thing. But yeah. Sometimes I think this is probably true in hospitals too. Sometimes that's just what you have to do. I think mentally and emotionally, like to take care of a large number of people at once is like just get the shit done, you know. That said, I will say the biggest hang up I've ever had with a nursing home is Sarah Polley's Away From Her, which like has as its premise this thing that who's the guy in the movie? Gordon
Pinsett?
Pinsett, I think, yeah. And then it's Julie Christie is the he like she has dementia and he like drops her off in the nursing home and they have this thing where they're like, we want her to acclimate to the nursing home. So we request that for the first like month or whatever that they're here, no one visit them. And I was like, what? And yeah. I talked to my mom who before her last job, she worked in assisted living and nursing homes in St. Louis. I was like, that's crazy. Right. She was like, yeah, that's crazy.
well, it's Canadian, right?
Maybe that's how they do that.
That's how they do it up there.
The Great White North.
I mean, the whole time they're like, we're really sorry, but you can't come here for a month. it goes down easier is what I'm saying. When
they say sorry.
They sit up there.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you know what, actually, and that's something, you know, as long as we're saying super personal things, having spent admittedly only like 5 days, I was at in a mental hospital many years ago. And
that's something else I forgot that you've talked about before.
Yes. Yeah. Sorry. Yeah. I'm kind of springing all kinds of things on you in this episode, but not really.
Yeah.
And that was a very interesting experience, certainly, because, of course, you're there. But I feel like just as a coping mechanism, you're also standing back and watching everything. And when you're me, you're just like, okay, how does this compare to, say, Shutter Island or One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest or whatever?
Yeah.
And it's like, it's such a different thing, because there are different wings based on what people are going through. And my wing was a fairly quiet one. But I know what you mean. Like, there was no Nurse Ratched or anything like that. Yeah. Like there definitely, you know, there were a couple patients who could get very emotional and very angry, not violently so, but loud. And like the nurses and the doctors, like they were very firm with them while still the whole time trying to cultivate a nature of, an atmosphere of support and patience, with a CE at the end, and that sort of thing. So yeah, that's definitely. And I remember, when I saw the movie Good Time, and at the very end, it's Benny Safdie, right? Who plays the character.
Now I don't remember. Forgetting. I want to say that it's Benny Safdie.
I think it's Benny, but anyway, so he goes to a hospital, and granted it's a different, his is a different situation, but the, you know, when they do have you do like these crafts and stuff, just sort of as a group therapy kind of thing. And boy, that really, I saw that. I was like, oh, okay. Yes. Now I remember this, and it was very, very jarring, but yeah. So that is definitely an experience that I've had that, granted, not a lot of people have had, thankfully. That's definitely something that will play into things, when I see, you know, mental hospitals. Of course, they're not going to, if something takes place in a mental hospital, chances are they're not looking for like a really quiet, nuanced experience.
Right.
You know, yeah. They want, you know, shock corridor or something like that. Okay. So a couple things that, I'll throw out: when characters drink hot beverages way too quickly, it's just like, I remember, because I drink a lot of coffee, and I drink it nice and hot. I don't like a cold brew or anything like that. But I remember one day I had a terrible headache, and I had Excedrin, but I didn't have any beverage with me except for coffee. And so I was like, well, I guess I'll do that. So I threw them in. And of course, when you're taking medicine, like with a beverage, you need a big swig of that beverage to wash it down. And I didn't think it through. And I was like, what was I? This is so stupid. I'm hurting myself. In that moment I thought like, yeah, this is the only time I've ever done this. And I see it happen a lot in movies. Now, granted, maybe their coffee got cold, but if that's the case, they probably aren't going to drink it. If it's in a mug and it was meant to be hot, and it happens all the time. And it's just, you know, clearly the actors, if they have anything in their mug, it's not hot. They're not going to be careful. Whereas anybody in that situation would be. And then this is very, okay. Yeah. I'll let this one be my last one. And this is very Austin Powers. We've talked about it before. Not so much, I mean, not even so much henchmen as like when I watch a slasher movie, or something like that. And I know that the nature of a slasher movie is just a high body count and creative kills. I get that. But I do have the thought of like, what is this kid's family? What are they going to think? Like they, it's like, yeah, the kid was like, you know, a horned up asshole, as we all were when we were teenagers. And so it's like, he or she didn't do anything to deserve this horrible mutilation of their body. And then I think like, oh, they can't even have like an open casket with this one or that one or whatever. And like, and I know like, that's not at all what I'm supposed to be thinking at all, at all. But I remember my friend Reed Lackey, he loves horror, but he has a similar sensibility. And he says every once in a while, like there'll be a death that happens and, you know, the actor or actress like really sells the terror. And it's like, oh yeah, they don't. Just because we all know what's supposed to happen to them, they don't know that. Yeah. And they're like fighting for their lives. And then it's cut short. And Reed had this, it's like, he goes, oh, that's, it's like, that's the end of their story, you know? And just, and so you just have this feeling like, what did they do as kids? Like what were they planning on doing as they got older? And then suddenly their life is cut short in this very horrendous way. And the last thing they felt was pain and terror. And again, you're supposed to be like, hey, high five, but it's hard in that moment for me. And I don't know why. It's hard for me to not think of what's left, you know, the family and think of like the last moments and all that sort of thing. So it's really dumb. And I realize this is kind of a sad thing to end the episode on, but that's a tough one for me.
Yeah, that's a very sad way to end the episode. I'll point out the thing I pointed out before. Increasingly, this is a good thing for society. Increasingly, people don't smoke in real life, but it's become apparent in the movies and TV shows. Increasingly, people like don't know how to smoke a cigarette or hold a cigarette.
Sure.
In the movies, that I noticed that as well. So that'll be a way to end on a not horrifying, depressing thought.
I had another one.
Okay.
That again, I know that I'm not supposed to think about how a villain, an arch villain, gets their lair built. I recognize that, but I remember I first thought of it in Batman Forever. You know, I was 13 when that movie came out, and certainly there's an expressionism to that. So the moment the Riddler exists as a person, his lair exists. That's just how it works. But as a kid, similarly to, you know, thinking about Dick Tracy and like, well, maybe this happened. But I was just thinking like, man, his lair is really, really complex. Like it raises up out of the water and stuff. It's like, who built this? How long did it take? And also there are question marks all over this thing. Like if I'm one of these contractors, I'm like, so wait, there's this guy named the Riddler who's, you know, stealing stuff and hurting people, and he leaves question marks. You know, I think maybe we have just worked for the Riddler, and I think we can maybe inform the cops where he can be found. And then as a kid, I was just like, well, maybe Riddler just killed them all. Maybe he paid them really well and then killed them all and then took all that money back. And now he doesn't. But it's like, but how many people would he have had to kill? It is. And yeah, that's, you're not supposed to think that way. But no, at 13, yeah. I was thinking that way. I wasn't thinking expressionistically, David.
Yeah. All right. Well, we've aired all our hangups. I think that's it, right?
I guess so. Yeah.
You can let us know what your hangups with movies are, or tell us how we're stupid for letting stupid things bother us in movies by commenting at battleshipretention.com. You can email us at david@battleshipretention.com or tyler@battleshipretention.com. You can follow me, David, on Twitter @DavyPretension. Please check out my other podcast. It's called The One Where I Met Your Mother, where my social worker wife and I watch an episode of Friends and an episode of Mother, episode of How I Met Your Mother every week and compare and contrast. This week we talked about the Friends episode where Joey and Chandler are babysitting Ross's baby and then actually accidentally leave him on a city bus. Whew. And then an episode of How I Met Your Mother that has become has a shot in it that has become a meme. I haven't seen it in a while, but it used to be a meme. I don't know if you have ever seen the meme of Charles Robinson, aka Mac from Night Court,
sure,
looking at something off screen and going, that's a penis.
I've not seen it.
Yeah, well, Bryan Cranston plays an architect who designs a building that we never actually see, but the show gets a lot of mileage and doubling, like, double entendre and innuendo out of the fact that he has designed a building that looks very much like a penis. And so that was the episode we watched that had that the origin of that meme. You can also follow Tyler on Twitter at Tyler Pretension. Tyler, what do you have to plug this week?
Nothing. I've been so busy lately taking care of the kids and stuff because there's a thankfully only a flu outbreak at the Smith household. So we've just been taking care of ourselves and the kids. So I haven't been working on anything lately.
Well, that's good. Try to take it easy, I guess.
Oh, thank you.
I guess other than that, thanks for listening.
We'll get you next time.
Bye.
Bye.
This program is a proud member of the Battleship Pretension Fleet.